morning. Welcome to the Supreme Court of the United States. During today's non-argument session, it is important that you remain seated or in silence through the court proceedings. When court is finished, we will rise silently and exit in the following manner. Those seated on my left, you will exit out the bronze gate on your right hand side. Those seated in front of me and to the right of me, you will exit out the courtroom doors in the back. If you see something suspicious, please report it to a police officer. In case of an emergency, remain calm and listen to the directions of a police officer. Thank you.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-191, Williams versus Reed.
This is a case about unemployment benefits in Alabama. The state of Alabama grants monetary benefits to unemployed claimants who meet certain criteria. To obtain those benefits, a claimant first must apply to the Alabama Department of Labor. In this case, 21 Alabama claimants applied for unemployment benefits, but they contend that the Alabama Department of Labor, in various ways, has unlawfully delayed the processing of their benefits claims. The 21 claimants therefore sued the Alabama Secretary of Labor in state court, the Circuit Court of Montgomery County, Alabama. Invoking Section 1983 of Title 42, they asserted, among other things, that the department's delays in processing their benefits claims violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Social Security Act of 1935. Importantly, the claimants did not ask the court to rule that they were entitled to unemployment benefits or to award them unemployment benefits. Rather, they simply asked the court to order the department to promptly address the benefits claims. Ultimately, the case went up to the Alabama Supreme Court, and that court ruled that the claimants first had to exhaust their administrative remedies under state law before bringing their Section 1983 lawsuit. The claimants then sought review of that ruling in this court, and we granted review, and we now reverse. In essence, Alabama has said that to challenge delays in the administrative process under Section 1983, you first have to exhaust the administrative process. Of course, that means that you can never challenge delays in the administrative process. That catch-22 prevents the claimants from obtaining a merits resolution of their 1983 claims in state court, and in effect immunizes state officials from those kinds of 1983 suits for injunctive relief. Under this court's precedence, however, Alabama cannot maintain such an immunity rule. As this court's cases have repeatedly held, a state law that immunizes government conduct otherwise subject to suit under Section 1983 is preempted, even when this federal civil rights litigation takes place in state court. On that narrow ground, we reverse the judgment of the Alabama Supreme Court. Justice Thomas has filed a dissenting opinion, part two of which is joined by Justices Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett.
Justice Kagan has the opinion of the court this morning, case 23-1127, Wisconsin Bell versus United States, ex rel. Heath.
The False Claims Act, I'll call it the FCA, protects federal programs and funds from fraud by imposing civil liability on anyone who, and I'm quoting here, knowingly presents or causes to be presented a false or fraudulent claim for payment. Now, as one might expect, the government can itself pursue people who violate the act by presenting false or fraudulent claims. But the FCA is unusual because it also enables private actors to bring suit against those wrongdoers on the government's behalf, and then to share in any monetary recovery. Today's case asks us to decide whether a particular kind of request for money qualifies as a claim under the FCA so that such a suit can go forward. The request in question is for monies provided by the federal government's E-Rate program, which is short for Education Rate Program. The E-Rate program gives subsidies to schools and libraries to pay for internet and other telecommunications services. To finance the program, Congress required telecom carriers to regularly contribute to a fund called the Universal Service Fund. That fund is administered by a private not-for-profit corporation. It's responsible for collecting the carrier's contributions, and when a request is made, for distributing that money to schools and libraries in accordance with federal rules. The plaintiff in this case is Todd Heath, who's a professional auditor specializing in the telecommunications industry. He believes that a telecom carrier, Wisconsin Bell, defrauded the E-rate program out of millions of dollars. According to Heath, Wisconsin Bell charged schools more than it was allowed to under the program, and that inevitably led the Universal Service Fund to make higher subsidy payments than it should have. To recover that money for the federal government and for himself, Heath brought this suit under the FCA. For the suit to succeed, though, Heath has to show that the requests for E-rate subsidies count as claims under the FCA's definition of that term. According to the part of the definition relevant here, a request for money counts as a claim only if the federal government, and I'm quoting, provides or has provided any portion of the money. So the question here is essentially whether the government provided any of the money used to pay E-rate subsidies. Wisconsin Bell says it didn't. It says all the money in the E-rate program is private rather than federal. That's because, Wisconsin Bell says, the money comes from private telecom carriers' contributions and then is handled and dispersed by a private corporation. So even if Wisconsin Bell committed fraud, it's not the kind of fraud against the government that the FCA is concerned with. Today, we reject that argument. We hold that the requests for E-rate subsidies in this case do indeed count as claims under the FCA, so that Heath's suit alleging fraud can proceed. We arrive at that conclusion because during the years Wisconsin Bell was allegedly committing fraud, the government itself transferred more than $100 million from the U.S. Treasury into the Universal Service Fund, that is, into the pot of money used to pay E-rate subsidies. About half that amount consisted of delinquent contributions that the Treasury Department obtained from carriers through debt collection efforts. The other half came from civil settlements and criminal restitution payments arising out of Justice Department efforts to police wrongdoing in the E-rate program. By collecting that $100 million, putting it into U.S. Treasury accounts, and then routing it to the fund, the government provided a portion of the money used to pay E-rate program participants. And that is all the FCA requires. The government doesn't have to have provided all of the money, just some part of it. And because the government did so here, by depositing $100 million from the U.S. Treasury into the fund to pay for E-rate subsidies, any request for those subsidies counts as a claim under the FCA. So Heath's FCA suit alleging fraud can go forward. The opinion of the court is unanimous. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Kavanaugh joins and Justice Alito joins in part. Justice Kavanaugh has filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Thomas joins.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court in case 23867, Republic of Hungary versus Simon.
The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, or FSIA, grants foreign states, as well as their agencies and instrumentalities, presumptive immunity from suit in the U.S. But this grant is subject to several enumerated exceptions. Respondents, a group of Hungarian Jewish survivors of the Holocaust and their heirs, sued Hungary and one of its agencies under one such exception, the expropriation exception. This exception permits suits against foreign states when those states take property in violation of international law and the seized property or any property exchanged for it has a commercial nexus to the U.S. Respondents allege that their stolen property has the required nexus to the U.S. because the Hungarian defendants expropriated the property during World War II, liquidated it, commingled the proceeds with other government funds, and decades later used funds from those commingled accounts in connection with commercial activities in the U.S. The district court held that this alleged commingling satisfied the commercial nexus requirement of the expropriation exception, and the D.C. Circuit affirmed. The Court of Appeals rejected the notion that the exception requires plaintiffs to put forth allegations that trace the particular funds from the sale of their specific expropriated property to the U.S. Because money is fungible, the court reasoned, that the statute permitted reliance on a commingling theory alone, and that a tracing requirement would render the exception a nullity. The court disagrees and therefore vacates the decision below. Allegations of commingling on their own cannot establish the requisite nexus. The plain text of the expropriation exception requires plaintiffs to trace specific property to commercial activity in the U.S., either the stolen property itself or property, quote, exchanged for, close quote, it. There is no dispute that such tracing is required when stolen tangible property is exchanged for a different tangible object. The statute does not draw lines between tangible and fungible property. Plaintiffs, therefore, must plead some facts that enable the reasonable tracing of the particular funds from the sale of expropriated property to the U.S. A commingling theory alone fails, as it distorts the ordinary meaning of the phrase exchange for in the expropriation exception. The theory relies on an attenuated fiction that all the money in a commingled account is property exchanged for the stolen property, no matter the size of the account, how much time has passed since the initial commingling, or how many intervening transactions in and out of the account may have occurred before the sovereign state used the account in connection with commercial activity in this country. That stretches the plain meaning of exchange for to the point of breaking it. The court's interpretation of the expropriation exception is consistent not only with the FSIA's explicit terms, but also the statute's history. The expropriation exception arose from a specific context, a case where money from Cuba's sale of expropriated property was traceable to the U.S. because Cuba segregated and deposited those proceeds into a New York bank account. Congress enacted the expropriation exception against this backdrop, permitting claims to proceed when there is a traceable connection between stolen property and the U.S. Congress also crafted the FSIA to conform fairly closely with international law norms on foreign sovereign immunity. Allowing a commingling theory without more would expand greatly the circumstances in which foreign sovereigns can be sued in U.S. courts for public acts, upsetting the balance Congress struck and potentially inviting retaliatory measures by foreign states against the U.S., an outcome Congress sought expressly to avoid. Today's decision does not close the door on all cases that involve allegations of commingling. The court holds only that a commingling theory alone is inconsistent with the expropriation exception. Other facts, like circumstantial evidence or the proximity in time between the commingling of funds and a foreign sovereign's expenditure for commercial activity in this country, may provide the missing link in a given case. The court recognizes that the moral imperative has been and continues to be to provide some measure of justice to victims of the Holocaust. The government represents that respecting the limits of the FSIA aids the U.S. efforts in persuading foreign nations to establish appropriate redress and compensation mechanism for human rights violation. For these and other reasons set forth in the opinion, the court vacates and remands for further proceedings consistent with its opinion. The decision of the court is unanimous.
Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court.
Murtaza Sutarwala.
Mr. Sutarwala.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of George Edwards III of the bar of the state of Texas. I'm satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Mr. Edwards will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Connecticut Italian American Bar Association, presented by the Honorable Salvatore Agati.
Judge Agati.
Mr. Chief Justice, And may it please the court, I move admission of the following attorneys from Connecticut: the Honorable Elizabeth Ann Bizzuto, Kevin James D'Adamo, the Honorable Anna Maria Ficito, Joseph Adam Mengacci, David Joseph Mons, Wendy Lee Pascal, Ronald Joseph Pugliese Jr., Danielle Suzanne Rado, and Carolyn Ann Signorelli. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Wake County, North Carolina Bar Association, presented by Jennifer Jones.
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys from the state of North Carolina: Turner Rice Albernez, Perla Maynard Alston, Matthew David Ballou, Sarah Covey Blount, Jennifer Ann Spencer Brearley, Elizabeth Carol Buckley, Aaron Ann McDaniel Catlett, Jonathan Edgar Hall, Donald Edward Horton Jr., Zachary Reuben Kaplan, Preston Wyatt Leslie, Hans Christian Lenartz, Ryan Joseph Mumper, Paul J. Purrier Jr., Daniel John Root, Andrew Mitchell Simpson, Christy Latanya Smith, Justine Marie Tate, Jessica Lynn Green Wilson, Nathan Ward Wilson, and Rebecca Louise Meyer Wilson. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Hispanic National Bar Association, presented by Cesar Estella.
Mr. Estella?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys: from New Jersey, Carmen Veronica Carrillo, Alexis Justo Fajardo, Ariana More, Maritza Rodriguez, Marihu P. Cedeño, Jessica Molinares Calpaquis, Fernando Carlos Rivera Maisonet, Camilo Andres Romero, Iris Santiago, Angeramis Tejeda, Christine Daniel Vasconcellos, and Jorge Luis Vasquez Jr. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
I do.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday at 10 o'clock.